which is Duroc versus Gonzalez.
Good morning. May it please the court. Michael Summerhill on behalf of the petitioners. This case presents three issues for the court's consideration. However, for purposes of time, for the oral argument, I'd like to focus just on one issue, that being whether the immigration judge's credibility determination is based on specific cogent reasons supported by substantial evidence in the record. And unless the court has any questions, we're prepared to stand on our briefs with respect to the other two issues. In a phrase, the adverse credibility determination in this case was wrong because it was based on assumptions and speculations, not evidence in the record. And in fact, evidence in the record actually contradicts the vast majority of the reasons supporting the IJ's adverse credibility determination. While we freely admit that the standard of review is a highly deferential substantial evidence test, the reason we give the immigration judge such deference on credibility determinations is because of the presumption that the immigration judge will know something more than this court, that by actually being at trial, by being able to listen to the testimony, observe the witness's demeanor, and even ask questions, that the immigration judge would know something that an appellate court just could not know.
But you're not suggesting, I assume, that we think immigration judges know things about, for example, country conditions or the condition of the Kurds in Turkey versus the Kurds in Iraq or
most certainly we are suggesting that, Your Honor.
You think they do know more about those things or they don't? I mean, I would have thought.
I think they're supposed
to. One of your points
to.
Is that we need a basis in the record for assumptions.
Correct. There should be a basis in the record for the immigration judge.
I mean, the immigration judge can't say, I wrote my senior paper in college on Kurdistan, therefore I'm going to rule in a certain way.
That is correct, Your Honor. And as this court has said on prior occasions, that we have an expectation that the immigration judges should know, and they should be aware of conditions in foreign countries. They should be aware that people in foreign countries are not treated in the same way that we are treated here, and that, in fact, those things do happen all the time. But this case, it was exactly that. The immigration judge did show a surprising unfamiliarity with the conditions in Turkey and what the Kurdish Turks are subjected to in Turkey. The very foundation, if you will, of the immigration judge's decision is that he just could not believe that a non-activist Kurd engaged in learning Kurdish language, studying Kurdish history, studying Kurdish culture would be to, quote-unquote, swept off the street for such, again, quote-unquote, innocuous behavior.
And what's your best evidence that that assumption isn't one that he was at least permitted to make, since obviously, as you conceded, the standard of review is a tough one?
It directly contradicts the country reports, Your Honor. The country reports give specific examples, numerous examples, the State Department country reports, numerous examples of non-activist Kurds engaged in similar innocuous activity, saying things such as, I'm proud to be a Kurd, and the 14-year-old boy who said that gets thrown in jail and beaten up. Parents of Kurds petitioning the school board to include the Kurdish language in the school curriculum, they get thrown in jail.
That's still against the law, isn't it?
It is still. Speaking Kurdish is still against the law. In public, it's still against the law. And because of, again, it just seems a complete unfamiliarity with the conditions in which the Kurdish Turks are subjected to in Turkey, he just could not believe that a non-activist Kurd would be subjected to this type of treatment. And I think it's important to point out, Your Honor, that these are the same country reports that this court has also said on numerous occasions that with respect to the United States allies, those country reports need to be read with a little bit of healthy skepticism because they can be expected to soft-pedal the human rights records of our allies, despite soft-pedaling the human rights records of a NATO member, Turkey. Despite doing that, those reports still recognize incidences of non-activist Kurds being subjected to abuse for quote-unquote innocuous behavior. Understanding that very foundation of the immigration judge's decision is not based on substantial evidence in the record, the other supporting bases, if you will, of the IJ's decision equally are lacking evidence in the record. There were five specific reasons, and in each case, one of which we just talked about, the inability to believe that a non-activist Kurd would be arrested, the other four bases are also based on insufficient or incomplete evidence. They're based on speculation, literally saying, I just don't believe this would happen, or asking rhetorically, what is it that he had done? Or, even worse yet, the IJ's decision to exclude the evidence that was providing the information that the immigration judge was looking for. None of these bases were supported by substantial evidence in the record. And as this court has said numerous times, where an IJ's adverse credibility determination is based on speculation or conjecture or otherwise incomplete or insufficient evidence, that credibility determination is not entitled to any deference. Once the immigration judge no longer bases that decision on the record, on the evidence in the record, his decision is not entitled to any deference. And unless the court has any other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Stone.
That's fine.
Brighton.
May it please the court, William Brighton with the Environment and Natural Resources Division representing the government.
You're obviously one of the conscripts, Mr. Brighton.
That's right.
These cases.
But it's a pleasure to be here. Certainly one of the key functions of an immigration judge or any judge who's hearing evidence is to apply common sense, listening to all the testimony, looking at the demeanor of the witness, and to evaluate whether the witness's testimony hangs together.
But Mr. Brighton, the problem here, you're quite right about that, but the problem here is that there's so much that this immigration judge either got wrong or was making what I might call kind of external assumptions. An immigration judge can certainly look at a witness and come to some feeling about whether the person is lying or telling the truth. But when the immigration judge says, I don't think third parties, basically, you know, Kurdish police, you know, the Kurdish individuals would be swept up by the Turkish police, That's kind of an outside the courtroom assumption that needs to have some basis in the record. And I'll tell you a few things that worry me about this particular conclusion. First of all, that Mr. Durgaj, does he pronounce it Durgak? Because the letter C in Turkish is often pronounced like a J. But he was only meeting privately when he's meeting in the cafeteria where he can be observed. Or the assumption that the police officers didn't know who he was when he's testified that they have his identification card. Or the assumption that the only reason the police would keep you would be to interrogate you as opposed simply to intimidate you, which might not involve any kind of conversation. Or the assumption that it mattered that he wasn't sure, you know, which branch of the police were sweeping him up. I mean, there are all kinds of things in this list of reasons that are quite troublesome, especially in light of the State Department reports.
Your Honor, I don't think those are assumptions. I think those are, most of them at least, are reasonable inferences based
on
the evidence.
But we'll take privately, that if he's sitting in the middle of the cafeteria, which is it? Does the immigration judge think they're not meeting in the cafeteria? Or does the immigration judge think that meeting in the university cafeteria is somehow private?
Well, the immigration judge clearly recognized that they were meeting in the cafeteria because the opinion says so.
All right. So why does he think that's private when anybody can walk by and hear them speaking Kurdish?
Because there's a difference between meeting in a public place in a group that's only discussing among themselves and having a group that's dedicated to making public displays of enthusiasm for a Kurdish cause.
Why do we know that there's this difference in light of the State Department reports, which appear to catalog instances where people are even just singing Kurdish, I keep confusing those two words, Kurdish songs? If you're meeting in a university cafeteria, as you well know from 20th century history, university students have been at the forefront of quite a few political action movements, whether it's the French students in the 60s or whether it's whatever we think that maybe they were Iranian students, I don't know, you know, but students throughout the world.
Well, I think we've all had the experience of meeting in university cafeterias over time, and so that's something within the normal experience of a judge, and you can simply evaluate whether that is designed to be a public expression or simply a gathering of students in a small area, which is really fundamentally, even if it's in a public place, it is a private discussion.
But how does he know that that's what the Turkish police will view it as if they're being monitored and people can wander by and hear this? You're making an assumption that the policy in Turkey of the Turkish police is to respect people's private space. And the State Department reports suggest that if you're Kurdish, maybe that's not true.
Well, I'm not making any assumptions at all about what the police were thinking, but the burden of persuasion in this kind of case where the issue is withholding of removal is on the applicant.
Well, it's asylum, too. It's not just withholding of removal.
I'm sorry?
It's asylum and withholding. It's not just this is not just a withholding case.
That's right, but in both of those, the burden of proof is on the applicant. And those circumstances, the persuasiveness of the story, whether it holds together in the big picture, whether the pieces of it make sense. And it's important to understand that it's not, no one of those factors was dispositive apparently in the mind of the immigration judge and adopted by the board. He listed a series of things that together persuaded him that the testimony wasn't credible, starting with skepticism because the lack of a history of activism made Mr. Durgak an unlikely target for the
there you have the reports, of course, where non-activist Kurds are harassed by the police.
The examples in the reports actually were singing a song at a union convention, which was clearly a public gathering rather than a private gathering in a small area of a cafeteria.
But that doesn't speak to whether you're an activist. That speaks to public-private. I mean, you could be some, you know, low-level worker not active in the party. I mean, the problem is whether these different elements are actually anything but 0 plus 0 plus 0 still equals 0, or whether you actually have something that will accumulate to the point where the IJ's decision can be supported.
Well, first of all, the asylum officer who interviewed Mr. Durgak originally, and then the immigration judge, and then the board all felt that there was more than 0 in these different factors. The initial skepticism because of the overall picture of this non-activist being swept up, you know, create some question. And then there were some specific discrepancies between his original written asylum application and his testimony at
were you
the
just
hearing.
Talking about the type of police branch?
Yes, Your Honor.
That doesn't seem very significant to me. I mean, people, and as it turns out, I guess, from the reports, the immigration judge's assumption, which you concede in your brief, about how the police organized themselves was probably wrong.
But that's irrelevant to whether it was a discrepancy.
Well, if you can get it wrong and the judge can get it wrong, why can't he get it wrong?
Well, I mean, because at least one of those was actually a Turk who one would think would know, if he was arrested by civil police versus gendarme, he should know which branch of the police
arrested him
if it actually happened. That seems to be central to the
question
of whether those events happened.
So in a drug case, when a bunch of people sweep in and somebody's from a task force with the DEA and somebody's a Chicago police officer and somebody else is with, you know, some northern Illinois task force, the drug people should be able to identify, oh, you were the DEA guy, you were the FBI guy?
Well, in this case,
the
country reports indicate that gendarme operate in the countryside and the civil police in the cities. This was clearly in a city. He was allegedly taken to a police station. You ought to be able to identify the nature of the police station.
And he eventually says it's the civil police. That's what he...
Eventually, yes. But at least initially he said gendarme in the application. And that's not like a testimony where he has to, off the cuff, respond to questions in a foreign language.
Why is that a telling discrepancy?
Well, because it's part of a pattern of whether the events occurred at all or whether it was a story that was made up.
What else is in the pattern?
The other things that were in the pattern were some of the details that he spoke of, the knowledge of the local police of his brother's circumstances.
Right, which, of course, there may be quite a logical explanation for, since we find out that the Turkish consulate was notified in the UK.
The Turkish consulate was notified in 1994. At least that's what's in the record.
Oh, I thought it was
in
2000.
That is not in the record anywhere. The affidavit of Dermis Durgak and also the testimony of Kahit Durgak himself was that the Turkish embassy was notified in 1994 of the application for asylum, and there's nothing in the record about whether it was notified in 2000.
All right, this is the excluded affidavit. I apologize that I'm thinking
right,
of
but the information
would have said he actually gets the asylum in August 2000, and that the Turkish authorities would have been told.
That's correct, Your Honor. All of that information, though, is already in the record, regardless of whether the application was excluded, because it came in through the testimony of Kahit Durgay.
Right, but, I mean, August 2000 doesn't sound like 1994. That's the distinction I'm trying
but
to draw.
But the affidavit only talks about notification of the embassy in 1994, not in 2000. That's not anywhere in the affidavit. Assuming that the embassy was notified, even if it was notified in 2000, how does that information get to local police in Nevşehir, which is central Anatolia, which is a place where Durmaz Durgak never lived, presumably the police there would not, one would expect, be particularly interested in him. So we have trouble with terrorists on a central watch list getting that information out to places that it needs to be, it would seem illogical that kind of information would be available. And so adding up these different things, the discrepancies between the application and the testimony at trial, the overall lack of likelihood of somebody with his innocuous background being swept off the streets, the fact that he testified that he was never questioned about his activities at all,
in my view that's sort of a nothing, since I think what the Turks would like is for Kurdish language and culture just to vanish. They have no particular grudge against the people, and the people who assimilate seem to be successful. It's the people who are risking Kurdistan reappearing they don't like, and so maybe they just want to say, you know, if you're doing this, life is going to be really unpleasant for you.
Well, Your Honor, I
don't know. But anyway,
yeah, that's an issue that's bigger than me. But in this case, what we have is an immigration judge who has made specific, cogent reasons for an explicit credibility determination. It was the foundation of his denial of the asylum application, and under the standard that the court has to uphold that unless the evidence not only supports a contrary conclusion but compels a contrary conclusion, we think that the immigration judge's decision passes muster and should be upheld.
Thank you, Mr. Bright. Mr. Summerhill.
As I think this court can see by both the government's brief and the oral argument, the focus is really the innocuous activity. That is the foundation, and again, that is completely contrary to the country reports. And so the notion that we have not met our burden, the whole basis of why the immigration determined that we did not meet our burden for eligibility for asylum was because the immigration judge did not believe Mr. Durgak's testimony. I do want to focus on two of the other reasons that the immigration judge gave, the first being the discrepancy, the so-called discrepancy. In Tolosa versus Ashcroft last year, this court, in analyzing a similar situation where there was a discrepancy between an army branch that arrested the woman in the application and then the army branch that she testifies arrested to her, the court said, look, that's not the linchpin. It's not who arrested her. It's whether this person was arrested, and that's our position here, is that we don't think there is a discrepancy. We think, and as the government has conceded, that the immigration judge got this wrong. He just misunderstood the country conditions in Turkey, which is kind of consistent with the overall flow of the opinion. But if there is a discrepancy, it's so minor, it doesn't go to the linchpin of what our claims are here. Our claims are not that it was the gendarme that arrested us. We were arrested because we were Kurds. We were a Kurd expressing interest in being a Kurd. The other issue that I want to talk about is the knowledge of the brother. As the judge, as you pointed out, he received asylum in 2000, applied for asylum in 1994. There are what I'll call somewhat differing evidence on whether or not the Turkish government tracks or does not track asylum seekers. There is evidence that the Turkish government does track Kurdish political asylum seekers, and perhaps not all the other political asylum seekers. That was the additional evidence that we were attempted to submit before the BIA on the motion to remand. Say, look, this is the additional evidence that draws the connection of how the government would know. If the government is tracking, keeping track of Kurdish asylum seekers, then the government would be aware of that. That's not an illogical step. And it certainly is the explanation that the immigration judge specifically looked for when he said, we never provided an explanation for how the government would know about his brother's status in England.
Now, is this only in the affidavit? And it appears that the affidavit itself is in the record, isn't it?
The affidavit was not accepted by the immigration judge. Took
Not the application, not the brother's asylum application, but is the affidavit, other than, I suppose, for reference purposes, maybe it's sort of in the record but not in the record. I mean, it's
correct.
There. I mean, we can sit there and read it.
Exactly. It's in the record, but it's not in the record. It's there for reference purposes. The transcript shows that the immigration judge said, well, why don't I just take judicial notice that he is a refugee in the United Kingdom, quote-unquote, whatever that means. Will that be sufficient? And silence. So there was the judge's decision to not accept this this affidavit. But then there's no question of whether the brother was a refugee. It's the other facts that the affidavit provide that explain the information that the immigration judge then uses against us for not having that explanation. Does it again with the lack of corroborating evidence. Well, there just isn't any other corroborating evidence. And the government does as well. So, well, what about the wife's testimony? What about the wife's testimony? Well, the judge specifically limited her testimony, told her, I only want to know what it will be like for you if you have to go back. That's not going to involve testimony about what happened to her husband while he was gone for 18 days.
I can take you back to the cafeteria for a minute. Do we know how many times they met there?
The record's not clear how many times. They did meet frequently. Your Honor. They did frequently meet in the cafeteria. They also met privately in apartments. What I think is important to note here is, as the government stated in the argument, is that we've all met in cafeterias and universities. We've all done that. What we haven't all done, except unless you went to college in the 60s maybe, is been surveilled by government authorities while you're meeting at the cafeteria. The country reports show that's exactly what happens. The immigration judge acknowledged it, but then couldn't make the next step. Well, they still aren't going to know who you are. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor. So based on as we've set forth in our brief and as the oral arguments say, we would ask that this court grant the petition for review. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Summerhill. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.